You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. From Daisy Shaw Ellis comes this, Field of Dreams, with photograph by Ina Jang. When Rolex launched the Datejust in 1945, it was an everyday watch, a stroke of beautiful efficiency in a busy post-war world. Its name signifying the tiny calendar at 3 o'clock. The new version, with diamonds for pistols on the 24 flowers that blossom across its face, is a wrist corsage of modern femininity. In addition to the blue photographed here amid thistle, the Datejust 31 comes in silver and olive green. Now for what's trending, clued in. Fall essentials embrace indulgent maximalism, feathered coats, vibrant blush, spiked boots, and brocade fit for Monet, plus an inclination toward only the merriest meddling. In the photo, pair au courant style with the voracious energy of Cher Horowitz in 1995's Clueless. In the photos, Prada coat, Miu Miu sweater, Dior men's tote, Boy Smells Woodforia fragrance, Gucci boots, Necessaire the sunscreen, SPF 30, Trinity for Kitos Abe of Sakai ring at selected Cartier boutiques, Westman Atelier vital skincare complexion drops, Louis dress, Louis Vuitton men's jacket, La Prairie skin caviar, Armani Litra, Vintner's Daughter Active Renewal Cleanser, Rowan Cheeky Cream Blush, Bottega Veneta Boots, and Alexander McQueen Pants. Now we move on to the fairground with photographs by O.K. McCausland. Downtown Darlings, Balthazar was the place. Fun was the time for Chanel's 15th annual Tribeca Festival Artist Dinner, celebrating movie stars and fine art by Britt Hennemuth. In the photos, Tribeca Festival juror Lucy Boynton photobombs Diana Silvers, Andrew Garfield and Diana Agron, Derek Blasberg, Christy Turlington, and Edward Burns are all ears, B.J. Novak, freshly pressed. Following a tour of the restaurant's bakery, Penelope Cruz and Robert De Niro cook up some laughs. Gracie Abrams will clink to that. Kimber Sprawl and Danae Benton. Judith Light, incandescent. Whitney Peak dishes with Evan Mock. Laura Regensdorf writes on beauty, outside interest. With its first complexion line, Hermes Beauty taps the age-old appeal of adventure. In the photo, Hermes Plein Air is an edited five-piece range, including an SPF skin tint and blotting papers. When Emile Hermes took the reins of the family saddle-making firm in the interwar years, a spirit of leisure-class joie de vivre hung in the air. He ushered in handbags and swimsuits. A circa 1930 advertisement shows a beach-going flapper shaded by a striped parasol. Pour les sports, pour les bains, pour les plages, reads the copy beneath a map of French tourist cities, plus a bonus inset of New York. It was a soigné invitation to get outdoors. Nearly a century later, that impulse returns with a debut complexion range from Hermes Beauty, the brand's young metier, whose color block lipstick cases made a splash in 2020. Plein Air conveys a certain idea of simplicity, of freedom, of movement and well-being, says Gregoris Pripilis, a Greek-born makeup artist who joined as creative director this year. It's a sunny day in Normandy near shoreline horse trails, and Pripilis is talking through the line. The complexion balm is the hit, a sheer tint with mineral SPF 30 in a dozen shades that suit a deep swath of skin tones. Along with its skincare boost, hyaluronic acid, evening primrose oil, the cat bears Emile's Ex Libris. There are two powders, Radiant Matte, paired with a chic goat hair brush, and Radiant Glow for highlighting. Inside the orange boîte are Japanese blotting papers, soft as silk, with tiny H watermarks. In Greece, your first books are about mythology, Pripilis says, tracing back an early conception of beauty that went beyond the goddess Aphrodite. There was Athena, so sportive and so powerful, with character. What is more radiant than a force of nature incarnate? Need for tweed. In the photo, a 1970s tweed look. In a twist of 1920s hobnobbing, the Duke of Westminster's Scottish tweeds helped inspire Chanel's enduring use of the material, from the original boxy suits to Karl Lagerfeld-era hot pants to Virginie Viard's feather sleeve shift on the spring 22 couture runway. Attention to detail is the common thread, as seen in this limited edition eye compact in four versions. Each shadow is stamped with a woven texture, and the tweed case by Maison Lesage Artisans is the perfect little jacket. Beau Travail, Dior Beauty, bottles up a storied Granville Rose for its newest skincare product. Pale pink plaster decorates the exterior of Le Rhum, a villa in Granville, France, where the Dior family moved when Christian was a year old. Named after the compass rose, a star-like maritime tool depicted in a floor mosaic, the property instead attuned the future couturier to the floral kind, pruned in the garden or growing along the cliffs. It's the wild variety that Dior Beauty has homed in on. Through a series of hybridizations, the next-gen Rose de Granville is the jewel of the brand's prestige skincare, with active ingredients harnessed from stem to petal. This year, the house inaugurates a 6-hectare garden devoted to the sustainable cultivation of these cosmetic powerhouses, powdery pink, like the nearby Le Rhum, now the Musée Christian Dior. Organic farming practices make use of companion plants to lure friendly fauna and deter pests. Extraction methods utilize cold pressure and electromagnetic fraction without the need for solvents. It all powers the latest innovation, rosapeptide, with 88 bioavailable rose molecules, the star of the revamped, refillable Prestige La Creme. Designed to spur collagen growth, it makes the idea of a perennial bloom something of a tangible reality. Keziah Weir on books, dark matter, courtroom dramas, and murder mysteries reach for bigger truths. True crime is booming on a spectrum from pulp to procedural, but the best of the genre seeks to answer questions more complex than whodunit. In No One Crosses the Wolf, out from Little A, Lisa Nicolaticus recounts her father's murder of his girlfriend and her daughter, followed by his suicide, and traces a family history of psychological manipulation. Two other books, treading only slightly further from home, weave memoir into the headlines. Linda Kinsler's Come to This Court and Cry, How the Holocaust Ends from Public Affairs, unpacks the case that threatened to exonerate a deceased Nazi who'd served in the same unit as the author's grandfather. While in Deer Creek Drive, A Reckoning of Memory and Murder in the Mississippi Delta from Knopf, the novelist Beverly Lowry juxtaposes her upbringing in segregated Mississippi against a brutal crime that occurred when she was 10 years old, highlighting stark inequities of class and race. And in Blood and Ink, the scandalous Jazz Age double murder that hooked America on true crime, from William Morrow, Joe Pompeo, Vanity Fair's senior media correspondent, traces the birth of the American tabloid industry and the dubious taste for exactly these narratives, to 1920s double homicide. Six-pack, Family Woes, 1980s New York City, and more new fiction. Afterlives, 2021 Nobel Prize winner Abdulrazak Gurnah depicts four residents of German-occupied Zanzibar in the lead-up to and fallout from World War I. The scale is both epic and poignantly personal. From Riverhead. If I Survive You, weaving in patois and varying points of view, these novelistic linked short stories by Jonathan Escoffrey follow a Jamaican family from Kingston to the beaches and urban sprawl of Miami. From MCD. My government means to kill me. The Chi writer and producer Rashid Newsom's debut novel presents as the memoir of a gay black man looking back on life in 1980s New York City. Even the footnotes are gripping. Published by Flatiron. My Phantoms, British novelist Gwendolyn Riley's trenchant story of an estranged mother and daughter, is bleak and hilarious. One character declines a funeral invite with, "I don't do family these days." From NYRB Books. The Unfolding. Following the 2008 election, one white American man is desperate to maintain control of his family, his money, the country, in A.M. Holmes's sharply honed novel, published by Viking. Touch. Olaf Olafson's tale of love rekindled finds 70-something Reykjavik restaurant owner Christopher reeling after shuttering his shop at the start of the pandemic when a former lover gets in touch. Published by Echo. On display, three authors explore private lives lived in public. Edie Sedgwick, in As It Turns Out, published by FSG, Alice Sedgwick Wall describes in intimate detail the short, explosive life of her younger sister Edie, from her abuse allegations against their father to her defining entanglement with Andy Warhol. Betty Gilpin. Through the 20 essays of Betty Gilpin's All the Women in My Brain from Flatiron, the GLOW actor describes heartbreak and connection on and off set. I tell myself I have found a version of it that is both cathartic and healthy, she writes. But maybe that's a lie. Edward Innenfull, British Vogue editor Edward Innenfull, fell in love with clothes at his mom's dress workshop in Ghana in A Visible Man, published by Penguin Press. He describes his all-consuming addiction to forward motion, from moving to London to pushing for diversity in media. A Brief History of Trump World Tell-Alls. The Trump administration is the publishing grift that keeps on grifting. A year and a half after the end of Trump's presidency, more than 10 of his advisors and lackeys have put out books. In August, his son-in-law and former senior advisor Jared Kushner will join the self-enriching authorhood. But telling the public all goes down easier with a cushy advance and a fresh chance at fame-balling. Here, five of the most recent broken down. By Arimatta Diop. Breaking History, a White House memoir, Jared Kushner, Senior Advisor, 2017 to 2021. The reveal, Kushner promises to bring readers inside debates in the Oval Office, double crosses at the United Nations, tense meetings in Arab palaces, and the daily barrage of leaks, false allegations, investigations, and West Wing infighting. The irony, speaking of meetings in Arab palaces, Kushner's new investment firm, Affinity Partners, recently took on $2 billion from Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund. Fidelity to the boss shows three hands-up emojis. Copies sold to be determined. The book, Here's the Deal, a memoir, Kellyanne Conway, Senior Counselor, 2017 to 2020. The reveal, I may have been the first person Donald Trump trusted in his inner circle who told him that he had come up short this time. The irony, she stacks her hit list with everyone from Kushner to Reince Priebus, going after all the men who have wronged her, including husband George Conway, but not Trump. Fidelity to the boss shows five smiling sunshines with hearts for eyes. Copies sold, 55,918. The book, The Chief's Chief, Mark Meadows, Chief of Staff, 2020 to 2021. The reveal, I didn't want to take any unnecessary risk, but I also didn't want to alarm the public if there was nothing to worry about, which, according to the new, much more accurate test, there was not. The irony, Meadows confirms the sneaking public suspicion that Trump was a one-man super spreader. Fidelity to the boss, we have three snoring zzz emojis. Copies sold, 21,825. The book, I'll Take Your Questions Now, What I Saw at the Trump White House. Stephanie Grisham, Press Secretary and Chief of Staff to the First Lady, 2017 to 2021. The reveal, with all the talk of sanctions against Russia for interfering in the 2016 election and for various human rights abuses, Trump told Putin, okay, I'm going to act a little tougher with you for a few minutes. But it's for the cameras, and after they leave, we'll talk. You understand. The irony, touching on everything from the former president's hair care to hangers-on like Lindsey Graham and Trump family dynamics, the Kushners were called the interns. Grisham's memoir is the overstuffed White House briefing she failed to give while in office. Fidelity to the boss, one skull emoji. Copy sold, 38,440. The book, A Sacred Oath, Mark T. Esper, Secretary of Defense, 2019 to 2020. The reveal, as demonstrators filled the streets around the White House following the killing of George Floyd, according to Esper's book, Trump stated, can't you just shoot them? Just shoot them in the legs or something. The irony, too bad the writer, lauded for score settling with an incompetent administration, had to wait for a payday moment to tell the American public the truth. Fidelity to the boss shows an upside-down smiley face. Copies sold, 22,798. Copies sold figures are from NPD BookScan as of July 9th. Now, from the Vanities, My Stuff, Family Matters, the brother-sister duo behind architecture and interiors firm Studio Shamshiri prove good taste is by design. Pamela Shamshiri, Stylefile, favorite accessory, I got a Gabriella Hearst demi bag in cognac leather as a gift, and I'm in love with it. It's like carrying a sculpture with a top handle. Daily uniform, Maria Cornejo and Jill Sander, usually navy or white. Style icon, Nefertiti, my Italian mother, and Franca Sozzani. At home, recent addition. I bought a series of 5 James Brown sculptures. I can't wait to install them. Pets, I have an Australian shepherd named Roquefort and 2 tortoises named Dwight and Jim. The menu, power snack, hard-boiled egg with whole grain mustard and a pinch of Maldon. For pleasure, reading The Uninhabitable Earth by David Wallace Wells. It's categorized by disasters. Ramin Shamshiri, style file, daily uniform, black, white, or navy button-down or T-shirt with acne black jeans. On grooming and wellness, everyday essentials, Nivea Basics Cream and Shaving Cream, Tancho Hair Stick. Workout, pool, speed bag, and hiking trails at Los Padres National Forest and Griffith Park. At home, dishware, splatterware from March SF by Nicola Fasano. Recent addition, we just incorporated a Jose Zanin Caldas leather woven daybed. On the table, peonies in a vase. Cookware, Moviel. Unexpected item on display, family portraits of us as chickens on plate by Constantine Kakanis. The menu, morning beverage, almond milk mocha.
Thank you.
Now for the Awards Insider Comic Effect. It's been nearly a decade since a network show won the Emmy for Best Comedy. Will the Pendulum Ever Swing Back? By Rebecca Ford. Opening photos, High Spirits. Kenta Brunson created and stars in Abbott Elementary, the most buzzed about network comedy of the year. CBS has seen Ghost soar. The Emmys must be a frustrating night for network TV executives trying to get their 10,000 steps in. They certainly don't get to walk to the stage much. Even when broadcast shows do step more outside the box, it can be a challenge to fight the perception that cable streaming is just cooler and more prestige, says Justin Spitzer, who created the new NBC series American Auto. The slogan, "It's not TV, it's HBO," has translated into a lot of network writers' empty trophy cases. Broadcast shows can't explore the dark side of human behavior like cable networks and streamers can, but surely a comedy Emmy or two should be doable. In 2010, when ABC's Modern Family won Best Comedy Series, executive producer Stephen Levitin told the crowd, "We are so thrilled that families are sitting down together to watch a television show." It was a sly reminder that the TV set was once the new fireplace, and that more families means more eyeballs and more advertising dollars. But Modern Family turned out to be the last network sitcom to win the award. Audiences have continued to fracture, and Emmy voters have championed shows, Veep, Fleabag, and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel among them, that you watch after the kids have gone to bed. Network series like Blackish and The Good Place have been nominated, but the Best Comedy statuette has always eluded them. In 2014, Netflix CEO Reed Hastings predicted that broadcast TV would be extinct within 20 years. It's kind of like the horse, you know. The horse was good until we had the car. This year, the horse has made a comeback. One of the biggest success stories of the season hasn't come from streaming or paid cable, but from ABC. I think whenever anybody says broadcast is dead, something comes along like Abbott Elementary that really strikes a chord and gets people talking, says Channing Junji, chairman of Warner Brothers Television Group, which produces the show. Abbott Elementary, nominated for 7 Emmys, including Best Comedy Series, is a cheerful, mockumentary-style sitcom about teachers at an underfunded Philadelphia school. Kenta Brunson, who created the show and stars in it, first found success on the internet making Instagram and BuzzFeed videos, but wanted her show on ABC from the start. "I was really interested in making Abbott for network, specifically because I wanted it to be watched by families," she says. Although we've gone so far with streaming, and streaming shows can be the most popular shows in the world, I felt like I hadn't quite seen sitcoms really thrive in those spaces yet. Abbott, along with American Auto and CBS's Ghost, has snagged both the aging broadcast audience and the streaming-focused younger crowd, essentially meeting every generation of the Modern Family on their platform of choice. Says Brunson, "When you want to create something that inspires family viewing, but is still funny, is still fresh, is still moving the needle a little bit, network is still the best place." Next photo, Motor Mouths. NBC's American Auto has captured both network and streaming audiences. It will probably always annoy me a little bit that some people can just easily whisk away network shows as somehow being an inferior product, says CBS Entertainment President Kelly Call, a self-proclaimed network guy who worked at Warner Brothers Television before joining CBS in 1996. "I'll stack our shows up against any on any other platform." Ghost is the top new broadcast series for the 2021-2022 season, Joe Port, who runs the show with Joe Wiseman, says people are always telling them how wholesome the show is. I guess it's meant as a big compliment when they say that. But the series, which follows a pair of New Yorkers who inherit a country home inhabited by spirits, is full of PG-13 storylines and innuendo. From a pantless, hard-partying Wall Street bro ghost who says he died after having sex with a limo driver, to a pair of ghosts attempting to create a throuple. It's not that wholesome in my mind, says Port, but we're getting to do the show that we want to do, so we're happy. Wiseman believes the show has grabbed audiences because it's about tribes of very different people learning to coexist. If the living and the dead can get along, in other words, there's hope for all of us. Wholesome may just be code for funny and feel-good, adjectives that, with the exception of Ted Lasso, aren't thrown around a lot in the era of dark prestige shows like Barry and Atlanta, which have recently dominated the Emmy comedy categories while expanding the definition of comedy itself. Abbott Elementary has a feel-good sheen to it, too, and far from giving off a broad, bland network vibe, it's grown its audience exponentially throughout its first season, particularly with the coveted segment of viewers ages 18 to 49. It's also the most tweeted about comedy series of 2022, according to Twitter, a sure sign that viewers are engaged. Disney aired the Abbott premiere on ABC on December 7th, then put it on Hulu the next day, giving audiences a month to find it before airing the rest of the series. That was the best advertisement for the show itself, says Craig Erwich, president of ABC Entertainment and Hulu Originals. That gave it a month or so for people to discover it on demand and evangelize on our behalf. Call is similarly platform agnostic in terms of how people discover his network shows. Of course, we want them to see it on CBS, but it's a new world. Thriving in that new world also means taking risk, even within the confines of a traditional sitcom. I think network is letting us do more than they ever have before in terms of pushing the envelope, says Spitzer, whose NBC series American Auto centers on the hapless corporate team at a Detroit car manufacturer struggling with one PR nightmare after another. From a driverless car that only hits black people to a serial killer using one of their cars in a high-speed chase. The show plays on Peacock the day after it airs on NBC, and more than one showrunner says that the pressure on ratings has eased somewhat because network execs are aware that audiences are finding the shows on streaming as well. Spitzer, who previously worked on The Office and created Superstore, says his live ratings are in line with those of other NBC shows. Numbers, he jokes, that they would have shot me for 4 or 5 years ago, and now gets us renewed. The streamers are coming around to the appeal of network-style sitcoms, too. Even Netflix is reportedly looking for a good old horse to ride, citing New Girl as an example of a show it would love to emulate. So, as streamers hew closer to the broadcast format they once claimed to be rendering obsolete, perhaps the Emmys will swing back as well. Creators are certainly giving voters enough comedies to take seriously. It feels like there's just starting to be a bit of a blurred line between broadcast and streaming, says Port. So I think, as those terms lose their meaning, so too will any residual bias against so-called broadcast, because it's really all just starting to be the same thing. Now on to the Encore category. Guess who's back? Back again, your favorite book characters, Tell a Friend by Keziah Weir. In the photograph by Josephine Scheel, the book covers mentioned in this article. After Andrew Sean Greer won the Pulitzer Prize for Less in 2018, his agent issued a single warning. Literally, she said, you can't write a sequel to a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Greer recalls. This month, he launches Less is Lost, the sequel to Less, about an author named Arthur Less on a road trip across America. He joins four other Pulitzer winners and finalists who have recently done their own serializations. Of major prizes awarded to American authors of literary fiction, the Pulitzer has a particular gravitas, due in some combination to its institutional backing, Columbia University, its longevity. The first awarded to a novel was in 1918, more than three decades before the first National Book Award for Fiction, and more than 60 years before the Penn Faulkner, and the "You Can't Sit With Us" hauteur with which the board reserves the right not to award a prize at all. There are no set criteria for the judging of the prizes, the Pulitzer website declares. The fiction prize is awarded to distinguished fiction published in book form during the year by an American author, preferably dealing with American life. This leaves a rather broad field. The five books in question are accordingly varied. Viet Thanh Nguyen, who won in 2016 for The Sympathizer, released The Committed in March of last year. The pair tells the story of the son of a Vietnamese mother and French Catholic priest as he serves as both a communist mole and a double-crossing underling in the first to a Vietnamese general, then escapes to Los Angeles following the fall of Saigon, and in the second decamps the underworlds of SoCal for those of France. In April, Jennifer Egan came out with a companion to her genre-busting 2011 winner, A Visit from the Goon Squad, a formerly inventive story cycle centered on the music industry. The Candy House turns various of that book's minor figures major, continues messing with form, and zeroes in on the tech world. Elif Batuman's Either Or arrived last spring as well. Its narrator, Salen, an undergraduate at Harvard in the 90s, who thinks about sex and The Idiot, a finalist in 2018, finally has it. And now Elizabeth Strout gives us Lucy by the Sea, not just a sequel but a crossover. The writer-narrator of Strout's My Name is Lucy Barton, 2016, and O. William, 2021, flees Manhattan with her ex-husband and titular focal point of Strout's last book, at the start of the pandemic, to settle in fictional Crosby, Maine, hometown of Olive Kittredge, the spiky anti-heroine of Strout's 2009 winner. While Greer wasn't aware of these books back in 2018, he might have directed his agent to other data. Alan Drury's Advise and Consent, the 1960 winner, was the first in a series of six. Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, which won in 1986, the first of four. Philip Roth's novel, The Ghost Rider, was a finalist in 1980. Five Nathan Zuckerman narrated follow-ups later, American Pastoral was the 1998 winner, after which Zuck returned three more times. John Updike won in 1982 and again in 1991 for the third and fourth books in the Rabbit Tetralogy, plus a novella. Sure, this is a scant handful, and the Pulitzer Board has awarded the prize under the designation of novel from 1918 through 1947 and fiction after that to 95 books, with 87 finalists. So for five authors to join the ranks of the above sinners in such close proximity is notable, particularly given that there is some anxiety about even employing the word. I'm supposed to call it a follow-up, Greer tells me, and not a sequel. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.